welcome to Open Source Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz of CFRU. I've got no other of, so... This is my of.
This is my of. This is where we are. So Merry Christmas, and, hope you had a good holiday.
We're just the general public, yes.
Yes, well, it's all because we are pre-recording, obviously.
We know everybody's at home listening to this, of course.
Of course.
What else would they be doing?
So, we hope you had a good holiday, and thanks for tuning in. It's going to be a good show. Open Source is a CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. Of course, you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. So this is one of our favorite episodes of the year. We get to do political movies. We get to turn our political show into a movie show for 1 hour out of 52.
We wait all year to do this show.
It's definitely not because we're lazy and it's Christmas.
No, we're probably at home right now watching more political movies, getting ready for 2019. No.
This is likely true. In fact, I might even go so far as to say I might be at the movie theater right now trying to catch up on stuff that I missed in the last...
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah,
definitely. We usually go on New Year's Eve.
Oh, there's...
Depends on the film, though. If it's a blockbuster, no. But if it's, something not quite as blockbustery, then definitely worth checking out.
Okay, well, that's not my list this year.
No.
Okay, so we're going to two each, and...
We don't know each other's picks,
No, we don't.
We're putting ourselves on the hot seat for...
for each other.
Yes.
Do you want to go first?
No, you go first.
All right, I'll go first.
I'll defer to the guy that has a movie show as well. So.
I appreciate that. So my first choice is They Live, the 1988 John Carpenter movie.
Wow, yeah.
About a man who finds a pair of, let's say, magical sunglasses that lets him see the world as it really is, which is... every billboard, every sign is a subliminal message telling you to buy more, to consume, to get married and have babies, to obey. Independent thought is, I wrote it down because I wanted to get it right. No independent thought is a sign. And of course, the bigger shock is that many of the elites he sees, if that would be the term we would use in 2018, that many of the elites he sees, upper middle class people, the wealthy, are actually these sort of skull-faced aliens. And they are in charge of basically the planet, trying to get us to basically kill each other and to not worry about the changes to the world, the violence in the world, the changing environment, just to get us to buy and consume and drive up their... profit margins as they're basically silently invading the planet. There's a line in the movie where the heroes, one is played by Rowdy Piper, the wrestler.
Is that his first acting role?
I don't know if it's his first acting. It's probably most.
I mean, wrestling is acting to a degree.
Sure.
But it's I don't want to offend you, but
it's definitely his most well-known role, I think, and probably his. He does a good job. He does good acting in it. And then Keith David is his friend in it. Somebody tells them at one point that Earth, for these aliens, Earth is their third world. So they are coming to Earth and exploiting our planet for resources and for money and for profit. I know that this movie is sort of complicated, not necessarily of its time, but in sort of the implications now, because a lot of alt-right people look at They Live as sort of, like a how-to, not necessarily a how-to guy, but you can certainly see how it speaks to alt-right people, because it's like all the elites are like trying to kill us and trying to get us to buy and consume, and they don't care about us, and they're these freaky monsters, and... of course, the whole thing ends with Roddy Piper, whose name in this is Nada. So
his name is not
his name is not.
They're not hiding anything, are they?
And yeah, and
you nothing.
So Nada and Frank end up like running through like this alien complex with machine guns, killing the aliens and killing their familiars, the humans who are working with them, to get to the roof of this television station where the alien signal's being broadcast that, you know, lets them disguise the subliminal messages in their alien visages. And you can see the appeal from an alt-right perspective because it's about two regular schmoes with guns saving the world.
Fighting the power,
saving the world. But it's so much more complicated than that, because what's interesting is, and I think Carpenter must have did this purposefully, when you put on the glasses, you see the world in black and white.
Oh.
So when you see things from their perspective wearing the glasses, it's black and white, and it's like...
You're for us or against us.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very pointed commentary that it's actually much more complicated than this. It's much more complicated than this part. A piece of this is right. There is an elite piece of the country who is profiting off of the widespread misery of regular schmoes, like Nada, who is like basically this drifter who comes into town looking for work. It's like
a cowboy film, sort of.
Right. Yeah. No, it is like that. It's never explained like sort of what he's on... drifting from, but you know, he might have gotten into trouble with some, that's kind of implied. And Frank, who he meets along the way, is construction workers move from the north. It's very obviously California because it was made in California, but he moved from somewhere in Michigan where he left his wife and daughter. He's been looking for work, and there's a squatters camp that he and Nada both live in, and it's sort of like a Hoover town, you know, if you think about the Depression. And it's a lot of that is sort of very pointed that, you know, we're just trying to get by. And there's a point where Nada or Frank, they're talking about, like, I'm just trying to keep my head down, do my job. It's the American way. Like, we'll get our chance. And, of course, that's not true to an extent anymore. And this movie is very prescient in that way that 30 years ago, it's only ever gotten worse. Like, there's really no American dream for anybody anymore. It's really hard. Social mobility is getting harder. The gap between the wealthy and the poor is getting harder. But I think it's a very forward-looking movie. But I think the danger is looking at it in a very black and white way, which is right there in the movie, because when they start seeing the world as it is, it's in black and white. And I think that was a pointed commentary that it's not black and white, but there's a piece of this that is very true, which is also why, like I said, alt writers have attached themselves to it.
For sure. And if there's anywhere in America where there is the equivalent of a Hooverville, is it Los Angeles that has the rows and rows of people just in tents? Mm-hmm. The climate is something to do with that as well.
Right.
The actual temperature.
Southern California.
Kind of like Vancouver is and can be as well. Now, I knew of this film. I think I recall seeing the preview years ago, but it's funny that you mentioned the alt-right. Because this was recommended to me quite a few years ago to watch again by a Christian person that I know, and it's his favorite movie.
really?
nothing against Christianity or anything like that. I'm not reading it into it, but this he's a fairly devout person, if I understand it right. And that may have been what put me off watching it again. But now that you've talked about it, of course, I'm gonna at least try. This is part of the beauty of the show. It's like, hey, yeah, I should give that a shot. Also interesting that you picked a film that's 30 years old. I mean, normally we tend to lean towards the newer ones, but that's a good pick.
Yeah, there's a lot to it. It's sort of John Carpenter's last classic too. Like, people recognize that the Carpenter trifecta, which is Halloween, The Thing, and Escape from New York. Those are kind of like his three movies. And then...
generally evolve everything going for
in
a
there,
dump, right?
Then, yeah. And then in there was Starman. And then he kind of has
Starman.
Then he kind of has a goofy phase with Big Trouble in Little China.
Oh.
And then They Live could have fit very well in part of that goofy phase because it's Roddy Piper, mullet that's as big as the day
as
long.
Which is also an interesting pick as a lead.
Yeah, but I think that's what plays into the sort of the goofiness and the cheeseballness is that and Keith David is like jacked in this. Like I don't know a lot about Keith David's filmography from from the 80s, but I don't remember him like in like subsequent to this like being particularly built in any other movies. He wasn't like a bodybuilder type. But
sure, but that doesn't go away necessarily once you've got it, unless you're right. like 90 years old. So it's he's hiding it under a cloak or something.
It could right? be, but you know, it's like they're both like beefcakes. They're both like walking around in like muscle shirts, and I mean, it was the 80s, but
yeah, muscle shirts.
It could have very much fit into that too, yeah. into that cheese ball period of Carpenter, and then after this, he does like. The Village of the Damned remake. He does the Invisible Man movie with Chevy Chase, and there was vampires
yeah, yeah.
and Escape from L.A. It's sort of like his last like, and I think it's quite accidental given the what's happened in the political culture. People have gravitated toward this because they see that they can draw those analogies. It's pretty straightforward. In 88, this would probably be very much science fiction. Be like, oh, like 88 was sort of the end of Reagan and the end of the 80s boom mm-hmm. and all that, but I think it feels like a movie that was probably made more with 2018 in mind than with 1988 in mind.
And that's fairly amazing.
Yeah.
Now does the political structure, let's say, make an appearance? Like you're saying the aliens or whatever are running everything, but does the usual structural stuff like Washington or whatever appear, or is it just is that kind of off in the playing in the background?
I think that's implied that they're kind of like instilled in all walks of life that there are aliens in the police department, and there's a scene where there's like a politician giving a speech talking about how well the takeover is going. I don't know if it's meant to imply that guy's like got an official position, like he's the president or he's like the governor or something. It's very much left.
It's left open to interpretation.
It's left ambiguous, which I think is probably part of the appeal, because anybody could be one of these aliens. And you see like the aliens on the street, like shopping at the grocery store, working in the bank. It's just, you know, anywhere where there's sort of money and influence, the aliens are there. And it's very much sort of like the downtrodden people, the people who live in this tent city. They're all humans. They're all struggling. It's fascinating when you consider like the conspiracy culture that's sprung up. And
oh yeah,
and it this movie could have been made last year.
Now it sounds like it may have been based on a book. Do you know, or
I think it was an original screenplay.
Oh, was it?
I think so.
Just from what you described, it kind of sounds like something that could be based on a book.
It could be. I will look up.
Sorry, but I don't want to put you on the spot there. I just wanted to.
It's all right.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it was Carpenter's own. Yeah, it's based on a short story.
Yeah, so there.
By a man named Ray Nelson called 8 o'clock in the Morning. But I imagine
we've had a lot of good films that have come out of short stories of feature length that have come from something.
But I imagine a lot. There was a lot of liberties taken.
Oh, for sure.
But certainly, it's interesting. It's like 90 minutes long, and it's got a really tight three act structure. And 30 minutes is about like getting to know Nadia, getting to know Frank, getting to know this like world of like the downtrodden, and then the second half is like Nada coming to terms with these things he's discovered. In the third act is he's managed to convince Frank. That's one of the cheese ball things in this, is that there's like a 5-minute fist fight with Nada and Frank.
The friends have a scrap.
Yeah. Cause Nada finds the glasses, and then puts them on, sees the aliens, and basically starts shooting up the place almost immediately.
Oh.
And so he's on the run. He's like, the police are looking for him. So he goes to Frank and he says, Frank, you know, I've discovered this weird thing. And Frank's like, dude, you like shot like 12 cops yesterday. I don't think so. And so they have this fist fight where Nada's like, you have to put on the glasses. Womp, womp, womp. And Frank's like, I don't think so. Like, you are a crazy person. I'm going to hit you back. And eventually Nada gets him in a headlock and puts on the glasses and reveals the world to Frank. And then they become friends again.
And
it's crazy.
Does Roddy Piper play the bagpipes at all? That's my only other question.
No, sadly.
No?
No. But he does have a pretty big knapsack, so it'd be hard to believe the pipes weren't in there.
You never know. Maybe small pipes or something. But
Anyway, I want to hear about your first pick, though.
My first pick, and both of my picks are actually from this year, which is unusual because I tend to go back in time as well for the retro stuff. Sorry to Bother You.
Okay.
Have you seen it? Or
I have not seen it yet.
Okay.
So but it was on, I can say, since we've also recorded... the end credit shows, I was on a couple of best of lists. It was also on one worst of list, though, I should say.
Oh, well, there you go. I'll have to listen to those for sure. So, Sorry to Bother You, written and directed by Boots Riley. Boots Riley is a musician, well-known, or mostly known as being a musician in a band called The Coup. And this is his first film, starring Lakeith Stanfield, who was in Get Out, which you, I think was your one of your picks. Was it last year?
He's done quite a bit. He was in Get Out. He was in the Netflix Death Note. And he's been in a couple other things.
But I believe he was in Selma as well, which he's a really great actor. But yes, absolutely.
He's a really great actor.
So the story in this film is Lakeith Stanfield's character, whose name is Cassius Cash Green. He's a telemarketer. He gets a job as a telemarketing worker, and he's living a bit rough. He lives in his uncle's garage. I should mention that this is Oakland. It's supposed to be, a parallel present day. They're not saying it's in the near future. It's sort of like you're just supposed to assume that things have evolved a little differently because it seems like a regular, everyday setting, let's say. So he gets this job as a telemarketing worker, and he gets a chance to move up the ranks in his company due to a hot tip. This is all in the preview, so I'm not giving too much away. He gets a hot tip from somebody he's working with who happens to be Danny Glover. says that, you know, to, I should mention, and if you don't know, Lakeith Stanfield is black. So this is black people working at a company. And Danny Glover, his fellow worker, says, you know, if you really want to move up the ranks, you should use your white voice. And then he starts speaking in these... They use these white voices, which are overdubbed. I think one is Patton Oswalt. I can't remember who the other person is. But, you know, they have the absolute most whitest. And then...
Patton Oswalt, great white voice.
So when he starts to do this, he finds that the people that he's calling change their tune a bit and are willing to listen to him a bit more. And, things improve for him so much that he moves up the ranks in the company to a division called the Power Caller Division, which it's moving on up in more ways than one because they take this gold elevator to another level of the company where there's calls going on that are a bit more nefarious, let's say. It goes from benign things like selling whatever to I don't want to give too much away. This is one of those where I don't want to give too much away because the surprise turns in it are fantastic. And in fact, beyond the point where he becomes a power caller, the movie takes I'm going to call it a sci-fi turn. It goes full on sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to spoil it once again because it's just so, you just kind of go, what just happened there? Which is part of the beauty of it. So I'm not going to give that away. I just want to tell you that there is a serious twist about two thirds of the way through the film. The boss of this company, the company is called Worry Free, by the way, is played by Armie Hammer, who is in virtually everything these days, right? I would call him a crazed capitalist. He's like absolutely out of control. This is the future where, the parallel universe, which isn't so parallel, not unlike the first film.
They Live.
I was going to say Get Out. I'm thinking Get Out, They Live. Get Out is also supposed to be like an alternate reality.
Well, I think it's it's like the real, like our world, but
supposedly
there's also the sci-fi element.
Is there a sci-fi element too? The twists keep on twisting. It's one of those ones where I want to tell you about this film, but I don't want to give too much away. So it's definitely a WTF moment when it happens. But it doesn't hide the fact that it's a serious critique of our modern society, not this parallel society, but critique of capitalism. The workers at this company organize and go on strike, and that becomes a fairly deep part of the plot as well. There's a riot, and the Cash gets injured in this riot, and he becomes a meme. He gets clobbered in the head by something, and it's like, oh, you're that guy, and everybody knows who he is. So it kind of echoes when... what happens to people when that happens as well. But and there's also this clandestine group called the Left Eye, which it would seem that Cash's girlfriend, whose name is Detroit, like they're not hiding anything in the names of these people, may or may not be a member of, who are, you know, I guess the liberation movement in the undercurrent of this world. I guess you'd describe it as a dark comedy. It's hilarious considering what's going on. It's like laugh a minute, I would say. I've also heard it described as a social thriller, which is a title of a film I've never... Have you heard anything being described as a social thriller? So it's like it's a thriller, but there's like a...
I would call Get Out a social thriller.
Yeah, okay. So this is something that's trending now. So
yeah.
I learned something new watching this film, or at least finding out what's... what people are calling movies these days, because I only watch black and white film. No, not true. So a lot of it will be familiar to people. I think they had a lot of trouble getting this film made. It, from what I understand, it took 7 years to get made. And it kind of speaks to, I'm going to say, the black experience in America, because nobody really wanted to back it. And Boots Riley said once... interestingly, Patton Oswalt got on board and some names got on board, happened to be white. That was when things started to roll for this film. So he actually ended up rewriting parts of it, including, interestingly, he had worked the line about Worry Free, the company was making America great again. He wrote this line before America was being made great again by 45. So he was obviously right on the right track as to where this was going to go. I know there are lots of films out there that take years and years to produce. But being a sort of smaller independent release, which actually did quite well for an independent release, was it the Toronto Film Festival? I think it may have been. In town, it only played at the Bookshelf and for a week. But the night we were there was the last night, and it was full. So there was obviously a very high demand to see this film, but it never, you know, it doesn't get to the Cineplex, right?
Well, it doesn't make it to the Galaxy.
Yeah, I tend to lean towards films that don't, unless they're, you know, something Marvel.
It opened at Sundance in 2018.
Sundance, okay. So Sundance, TIFF, that's kind of where...
Yeah, they're both the same.
In some film, well, no, but similar in that there's most of the films end up sort of, I'm going to say, the Netflix graveyard. It's not really a graveyard, but it's like... might get 2 or 3 or 4 stars. This was actually rated 93% on the Rotten Tomatoes. So if that's do you stake anything on the Rotten Tomato ratings? Do you ever say, oh, that's got 100, I'm going to watch it? As a movie person, as a buff, as a reviewer.
I don't really base anything on Rotten Tomatoes. I mean, it's interesting. But I think...
I mean, if something's a splat, which is a Rotten Tomatoes rating, I wouldn't watch it probably. But there are times where it's like, oh, I'm going to...
I mean, a lot of... You see this in some of the clips they post on the reviews. It's, you know, the reviews are so much more complicated than fresh or rotten. You know,
there's nuance there.
There's nuance. Yeah. And sometimes you see that in like the pull quotes from the different reviews they pull. So I can't say I've put a lot of stock in Rotten Tomatoes over the years. I mean, If I'm interested in seeing something,
just go.
And I look at the tomato rating and it's like got 80, 90%, I'll probably be more interested in going. But if I'm interested in seeing something, I see it's got like a 50 or a 40, I might start to wonder. But I mean, if I want to see something, I'll see something. I mostly use...
And that's probably the way to do it, but...
Probably.
You also have a whole show where... seeing movies is part of it. So.
Yeah, it's the whole thing about putting on your white voice in Sorry to Bother You is interesting, because that's of course part of the plot of Black Klansman, where where it's based on the true story of Ron Stanfield, who basically sees an advertisement in the paper. Call if you want to be a member of the KKK. And so he calls the number. And Ron Stallworth is his name, sorry. He was a black police officer with the Colorado Springs Police Department. Mm-hmm. And there's I don't know if this is from real life or it was embellishment, but there's a whole conversation where Ron Stallworth is on the phone with David Duke. And he says to David Duke, you know, how do you know you're talking to a black person? Or how do you know you're talking to a white person and not a black person? And David Duke starts espousing about how when you're talking to a white person, there are certain things you recognize, like the way they say certain words or the way they use certain... And it's like this very sort of like quasi-intellectual justification for his racism. Like, white people talk a certain way. It's almost like a stand-up comedy routine. White people talk like this while black people talk like this. It'd be funny if it weren't so insidious.
But if I understand it right, that was a real, maybe not word for word, but that conversation did happen.
Yeah.
And David Duke, who was still makes an appearance. He came out in favor of Trump in 2016, so he's still around.
He still comes out of the muck occasionally.
Yeah, he's had a couple of facelifts trying to sort of maintain that white white beauty white virility, standard, I guess I'm going to say. Yeah. it's not really working for him. But it his really line, isn't. I guess we're deviating from there. There are a lot of parallels between Sorry to Bother You and Black Klansman. it almost sounds like a stutter, but Black KKK Klansman. That David Duke uses the line America first.
Right.
And I think that was actually a KKK thing back in the day.
I also think Spike was, considering how much he's preoccupied with the connections between Trump and the Klan, and especially the last sequence in the movie, I think that was a very pointed use of that phrase.
And if I understand it right, because again, sort of tying these two movies together, that Boots Riley took issue with some of the stuff in Spike Lee's film, and I guess there was no response from
Spike. They had
Spike,
a beef. So. Well, Boots Riley had a beef. It's interesting that Spike Lee didn't respond, because I feel like if it was like 10 or 15 years ago, Spike Lee would have definitely responded. Mm-hmm. So maybe he's
But now he's establishment.
Out.
No, sorry.
Well, he's at the very least chilled out. I mean, he's got to be in his 50s?
Yes, maybe a little, maybe even a little older. So, well, Do the Right Thing was around the same time
Do
as
the right
They
thing
Live,
was,
right? Like 88 or somewhere.
Do the Right Thing, I think, was 89. Uh-huh. So,
And funny enough, I saw both of these films almost back to back, and the parallels were fantastic, because you can tell they both come from the same kernel, the same source, which is pretty much Black America amongst all of the other things that are discussed. And they're both funny as hell too. So
this is almost
like a joint recommendation. It's like, go see both of these films.
Sorry to Bother You is definitely on my list to catch up on. I realize there's spoiler stuff that you can't go into.
Yeah, so. I'd love to tell more about this film, but you're not expecting it all. You're expecting this to go a certain way, right?
Right.
So, but I guess because it's Boots Riley and he's a new director-writer, and I'm sure what will come of this, there's obviously going to be more from him, because I think this did really, really well. It just didn't, wasn't an indie release that died off, so it's got some traction.
It wasn't Avengers Infinity War.
It's got lots of tomatoes. Yeah, exactly.
That's an inside joke from, I think, next week's episode of End Credits. So we're going to take a break here and play a little bit of music, as we normally do, and then we're going to come back with our next two picks. You're listening to Open Source as Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
And that was the Dukes of Dixieland from a compilation album, New Orleans Christmas, and the song is or was Holiday Time in New Orleans. A little bit of a spin on the regular Christmas stuff, because we don't do Christmas stuff here. We do it with a big, brassy, and bold.
See last week's show.
Yes.
Or 2 weeks ago now. So.
That didn't get you hopping.
Gets you hopping.
Should do.
Although Christmas was 2 days ago, as of when this will play.
Yeah, but the radios, other stations will still be playing Christmas music. So you stuck that in there. We don't want to hear it anymore.
Maybe. You might be right. You might be right. So. All right. So we're doing our political movie show special, as we do every year. So I did They Live. Scotty did Sorry to Bother You. So we're going to do our next two. And since I started the last segment, why don't you start this segment?
You want me to go?
Yes.
My next pick is Fahrenheit 11/9.
Oh, Mikey Moore.
By Michael Moore. It could possibly be the most overtly political mainstream release of 2018.
Not Michael Moore. No way.
I think this film took some time to be made as well, not unlike Sorry to Bother You, because the, if I got it right, the Weinstein Group were involved. And it was right about the time where all of that started to collapse due to Me Too and other things.
Right.
So this became a different movie as well, and it led right into the election. It was, I would say, a shameless lead up to the election of 2018. That's what made this overtly political, in that it was like, okay, this film was designed and was released just before the midterm elections, which we obviously talked a lot about on the show. But this was Michael Moore's take on it, the lead up. The question is posed right off the top: how the beep did this happen? And funny enough, Michael Moore was one of the people, one of the few people that said, "Don't kid yourself. Donald Trump can win this thing." And yeah. I actually read he wrote up a little blog post and rationale as to why Trump could take it. And he suggested that in places like, the Rust Belt of, say, Flint, Michigan, where Michael Moore is from and tends to appear in every one of his films, but also Flint has been having the water crisis in Flint is directly relates to the how did all of this happen. So Flint makes an appearance in his film. It's classic Michael Moore, and you've probably all seen a Michael Moore film. His formula hasn't really changed too much from Roger and Me. So, fast forward from, again, late 80s. We seem to be hanging around the late 80s in terms of, I think Roger and Me was 1990, I believe.
Yeah, at least.
So structurally, this film is basically the same, where it'll be, it's very dark humor. There's a point where Michael Moore will do something funny. And since it's in the preview, I'll tell you about this, where he takes a truckload of Flint water and sprays it on the governor's house, presumably contaminated water from Flint. But there's also, he manages to cram a lot into this. And we talked about it on our other, the 200th episode about the kids from the Parkland shooting, who have become seriously politically energized. He kind of hangs out with them. And
David Hogg just got into Harvard, by the way.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
And he's dyslexic too, so he's managed to overcome that, among all the other things, including being in a mass shooting. So congratulations to him, because we know he's listening. No.
That's right. He could be. You never know.
So Parkland shooting and Flint. And he also goes around to certain candidates that are running, that were running in the midterms, a few of whom got elected and a few didn't. In the preview, he interviews a guy, and it comes across as if this guy is some kind of Republican, where he says to Michael Moore, I'll fight you out in the street. It's skillful editing, because this person is actually a Democrat, but he's jacked up. He's kind of pumped. He could be in They Live, probably, and they have this interview. And when Michael Moore's pulling this face, but in actual fact, this guy was... I believe he ran in Lawson. His name escapes me right now. But he's actually a Democrat. He's sort of like the other, we'll call him the other side of the Rust Belt. Because there is Michael Moore's, I'll call it his genius, I guess, is that he gets Trump, and he understands the people that are willing to vote for him, because he came, his origin story, his father worked for General Motors, now gone. Obviously that was a big part of Roger and Me.
It was Roger and Me.
It was pretty much Roger and Me. And GM pulling out of Canada. And if that's your origins, then it's like his best buddies are still in Flint. Mm-hmm. So he knows how to tell that story. I will say it was a bit, I'm going to say, overbearing at one point, where this is like, he kind of jacks up the intensity, where he draws this parallel between Hitler and Trump. So he plays the Hitler card he doesn't. I understand what he was trying to say in terms of, this is how fascism happens.
Right.
But he was trying to draw, and he draws the parallel between the two in terms of, all of the factors that led up to the rise of Hitler are very similar to the ones that have led to the rise of Trump, albeit the end result is different. But contextually, he doesn't really, he presents it with his not very much explanation as to why he's drawn this.
Right.
It's obvious to anybody that's watching, and anybody that's sympathetic to the story, what's going on. But, you know, the, you know, you always say about play, oh no, you played the Hitler card. Did you have to play the Hitler card? He probably didn't have to play the Hitler card to make this movie decent.
Well, the important distinction between Trump and Hitler is that Hitler was vicious and somewhat competent at in terms of execution. Mm-hmm. Trump is not competent. Trump is not vicious. And, you know, maybe he's vicious on Twitter, but he won't,
he's
he won't be confrontational.
No.
Like, I don't think Trump would ever order the killing of somebody, which I think is an important
thing. Well, didn't he say, though, he could walk along the street and I could shoot somebody and nothing can happen?
He could, but, I mean, Trump won't even fire people to their face, so.
Yes, either with... Well, he did on his show, though, didn't he? No, but anyway.
I mean, reality is show, yeah.
Yeah, the reality show.
That was part of the
shtick. So we're living the reality show. So, I mean, that I would say that was the... That was maybe a little bit too much, but other than that, it's a standard fare Michael Moore story, and I don't think it's going to. I don't know. I think I rewatched Roger and Me a few years ago, and it holds up. I think because this is such a period piece that you know, in the future it may not carry as well. It didn't do as well at the box office as actually Fahrenheit 9/11.
Well, that doesn't hold up either. That's very much of a time.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it landed at the right time because I think it did really well at the box office. That was
yeah,
the film
it did. Yeah.
Regarding the Bush years and whatnot.
It was also his follow-up to Bowling for Columbine.
Mm-hmm. So we're living a bit in a different world, let's say, in terms of how deep an influence a Michael Moore movie can have, I think. It obviously has very little influence on us here in Canada. It's always interesting to watch what's going on from a distance. There is some crossover, I guess, in terms of the issues that are covered. And of course, I don't know, every film I seem to rate has a strike in it. To be a political film must have labor unrest in it, or it doesn't make the cut. He goes and talks to the teachers that were striking in Virginia, who are, you've got people working, teachers working minimum wage and basically giving blood platelets and stuff to pay the bills.
Yeah.
So he definitely covers all of the usual bases that he does. It's like, so why is, you know, how the blank did this happen? He also introduces Trump. I don't know if it's at the very beginning of the film. He says, ladies and gentlemen, the last president of the United States is this, you know, we're waiting for the bomb to drop. I suppose lots of bombs have dropped of sorts of Trump in recent days. And I'd be interested to hear what Michael Moore's opinion is on, in terms of, will Trump survive everything that's going on, or is he just going to, you know, impeached or disappear? Because he definitely, he called it. And he talks about it in the film, too, how it's kind of revealed that Michael Moore is, he sort of is a character, you know, he's the host, the main person in the film, but also he's a character in it as well. And like, you know, Michael Moore, you know, they do the skillful editing of every appearance he had on a talk show or whatever. It's like, Michael Moore says that Trump may win. And everybody's like, oh, no way. There's no way. Hillary's got this in the bag. And then he's like... But then we know what happened. You know, that the atypical Michael Moore voiceover. So if you're a fan.
Victory lap, yeah.
Yes. If you're a fan, definitely check it out. Like I said, I think it was the most political, outwardly political movie of 2018. But I would catch it soon or within a year or two because it'll just start to, you know, it starts to date itself. But hit the bar anyway for me, so.
I'm interested in checking it out, but I mean, Michael Moore's kind of like a regular guest on MSNBC, so I feel like I know his thoughts on what's going on.
Yeah.
I chose something that was similar, but a little bit different for my second choice. It is a 2013 film called White House Down. And it is also about a disaster at the White House, but it is about, a group of terrorists who seized the White House and tried to take the president hostage. President's played by Jamie Foxx. And it almost works, but Channing Tatum was doing a tour of the White House with his daughter that day. And he's a member of the Capitol Police, and he ends up saving the president. And
he's got pipes, so look out.
Dad
with pipes is coming.
Yeah, Channing Tatum's seen the inside of a gym a couple times. It's about them trying to get out of the White House, trying to evade the terrorists, and about the terrorists and their convoluted plot to either get rich by taking the president hostage or trying to get access to America's nuclear missiles to unilaterally wipe out Iran, which are both subplots in the movie. But it's a lot. There were two movies about that was basically Die Hard in the White House that came out in 2013. One was this, and it's directed by Roland Emmerich. And the other one was White Olympus Has Fallen, which I think was Anton Fuqua. One of the Olympus Has Fallen is kind of more hard R rated, very much like lives up to the name Die Hard in the White House. This one by Emmerich is much more popcorn. It's much more of a buddy cop film with Tatum and Fox. And the reason I chose it is I just wanted something fun.
All these serious movies.
It takes place in the White House, so it's political, and it's got, I mean, it does have this political subplot about, you know, the president, played by Jamie Foxx, wants to sort of power down the military. He wants to, like, pull out of wars and things and focus more on humanitarian and peace endeavors, like not buying so many planes and aircraft carriers and things. And this has apparently upset a lot of people who think that, you know, no. It's the whole military-industrial complex thing. So, I mean, it's political like that, but it's mostly just about, like, Channing Tatum doing a Bruce Willis impression with Jamie Foxx basically doing a Barack Obama impression, you know, broing out as they're like fighting terrorists in the White House. Roland Emmerich, I think this is his fourth time destroying the White House.
Independence Day, is that him?
That's, yeah.
Okay, Independence Day, right away, because I see that the alien ship blowing up that.
Yeah, that was number one.
Yeah.
Number two, you don't see it on screen, but you have to assume in The Day After Tomorrow, the White House is,
it's
at the very least rendered inhabitable because of the new Ice Age.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third time was 2012, where the White House is wiped out in a tsunami. All of Washington is wiped out in a tsunami.
John Cusack?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Cusack. I did see that one. Basically, it's the end of the world.
The little chihuahua can't make the boat. Is that that one? Yes.
It's basically the end of the world, and all the rich people are saved, and John Cusack's family. It's very cynical. But White House Down is a lot of fun, at least for me. Apparently, Barack Obama saw it and enjoyed it.
Oh.
So if Barack Obama liked it, I think it gives permission to the rest of us to enjoy it. Definitely, there's a lot of fun scenes, but I think the best one is when Channing Tatum and Jamie Foxx get out onto the White House grounds in the presidential limo, and they're sort of driving around the White House long as these terrorists are chasing them in like the Secret Service SUVs and like firing at them. And so they're trying to figure out how to get off the White House grounds, which is of course surrounded by this big fence, and they're like, we have to get through the gate. And for some strange reason, there's a grenade launcher in the back of the presidential limo.
Oh, just handy, ready to go, yeah.
But the best scene is Jamie Foxx as the president leaning out of the limo, the window of the limousine, with a rocket launcher trying to blow up a hole in the White House fence. And there's even the reporters who are like reporting on this overhead in the newscopter, and the reporter's like, "Is that the president with a rocket launcher?" But it's so much fun just for me, and there's a, you know, the cute kid subplot with Channing Tatum's daughter, who's like very politically active. That she has like a video.
Save the whales, kid.
She has like a video, like a YouTube page or something, and she actually, because of her, she's got her phone with her, and she actually films the scene of all the terrorists coming into the White House. And she's
tech savvy.
Yeah, she's like a little Harriet the Spy action, and she posted on her YouTube page. And then there's at the end, not to spoil anything, but eventually the Speaker of the House, played by Richard Jenkins, becomes the president, and he's like, we just got to end this whole situation, so we're going to carpet bomb the White House and kill all the terrorists. And so at the end, it's like the final fight with Channing Tatum and the head of the Secret Service, which I'll get to in a sec. But Channing Tatum's fighting the head of the Secret Service, who was kind of the mastermind of the whole double agent, yeah. And the airstrike is coming in, and Channing Tatum's daughter goes out with like the American flag and starts like waving the airstrike off. It's
because of course they can see that from way up,
right? And
in the jets.
And the guy leading the strike is like, no, I'm not gonna like fire on the little girl with the flag.
And she's waving the flag.
It's so...
I can see this whole thing.
It's so cornball. It's so cheesy. It's so great. The head of the Secret Service is played by James Woods, who, of course, very famously is like pro-Trump, crazy, pro-Trump. Anti-Obama nuts.
But he has to do things to pay the bills, so that's how
he has to pay the bills, although he might have some trouble paying the bills because he's so Trump, gaga for Trump that, you know, he's become sort of toxic. I mean, there was also some Me Too allegations about him.
Yes.
But, he's become so... It's the one of my favorite scenes in the film is he manages to actually come face to face with the president near the end of the film, and Jamie Foxx comes in and goes, you know, I say this with all the weight and, you know, power of my office, and it's one F-bomb in the film, because if you have a PG-13 movie, you can do the F-bomb.
You can drop one.
And of course, he comes in and he says, like, you know, I say this with the full weight, power, and you know, history of my office, F you. And it's just, it's so, so
bang on,
so
eh?
Lightly done. It's so great. It's just a lot of fun, this movie. A lot of great actors in it, too. You know, Roland Emmerich's able to attract top talent for these little things. Like, Maggie Gyllenhaal's a Secret Service agent.
Oh.
Like I said, Richard Jenkins is the Speaker of the House. His name? I'm trying to think about it. Anyway,
Did this get wide release?
It did, yeah.
It did. And you saw it in the theater?
I didn't see it in the theater. It wasn't a big hit. I saw it on DVD afterwards.
Right.
But
and the kids say, "What's a DVD?" No, but yeah.
Well,
DVD.
I'm pretty sure it's. I think it's on Netflix. It may be on one of the streaming services.
I'm definitely gonna try and find it. Now, do you know? Is there a set somewhere in America that always stands in for the White House? I'm thinking along the lines of, and they filmed all of House of Cards, and
yeah,
it always tends to look consistent, or the West Wing. Or this film that you're talking about, is it just like skillful set building, or is there somewhere, there has to be somewhere in America that's not, because they obviously can't use the White House.
No.
I guess it's like when they use, fake Buckingham Palace in the Crown or whatever. It just seems to be so many movies that involve the White House that somewhere there must be, somewhere there's a soundstage in probably California.
Well,
it's got a White House.
I'm glad you asked that, because they actually shot this whole thing in Montreal.
Get
with the exception
out.
of second unit, like, establishing shots. It
I
was
bet
all
they
shot
used
in Montreal.
The Montreal Public Library, one of the main old library in Montreal downtown, because it kind of resembles the New York Public Library built, I think, around the same time. And I'm talking about the old library in Montreal, not the new. There's a new
there's
giant
a new old library.
Library. There's a new giant library in Montreal as well. But
from what I gathered for this, they built like a White House set in a soundstage, including the exteriors.
And they blew it up.
Well, yeah. that's what's hilarious is that in both Olympus Has Fallen and White House Down, there's a reference to the burning down of the White House in 1814 by Canadians.
Trump referred to us doing that. They burnt us at a...
Well, I mean, we weren't technically Canada as a country, but it was the Canadian regulars, people born in North America, in Canada, who went and did it. And of course, that's part of the climax is that Channing Tatum is like trying to figure out a way to like get the last few terrorists off their game. So what he does, he goes to the residence and starts setting it on fire, which causes like all the alarms and the sprinklers to go off and everything. And so it gives him like the tactical advantage he needs to finish off the last couple of terrorists.
So he must be a Canadian.
Channing Tatum?
No. I mean, the role itself. I'm just kidding.
But I mean, that was also part of the plot in Olympus too, or at least it was mentioned. I can't remember the exact plot of Olympus. The two are kind of similar in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Roland Emmerich is not like one of the most brilliant filmmakers, but he.
Ooh, don't let him know that.
Well, yeah, but I mean, this is sort of like a rare sort of, I think, win for him in the last, because he's been trying to like do like semi-serious things. Like he did Anonymous, which is this movie that's about the conspiracy theory that Shakespeare didn't write Shakespeare's plays.
Oh,
and he did a movie about the Stonewall Riots, which I haven't seen, but from what I gather is
that was one that caused
utterly
the controversy.
It's like utter garbage.
Hmm. I know the LGBTQ community.
And then he did the Independence Day sequel, which is also utter garbage.
Not hitting the bar anymore.
There
was a bar to hit.
Yeah, well, there's one clever bit in Independence Day Resurgence, which is it's an even bigger alien ship that's like the quarter the size of the planet. It basically comes down and latches on Earth. And you see one of the landing gear of it, and it's like going along. It's going along like through the Washington Mall, and it's heading towards the White House. And they rebuild the White House for the sequel, or in the world of the sequel.
In the world of the sequel.
And you see it like heading towards the White House, and you're like, oh no, they're gonna wipe out the White House again. And then it stops just short of mowing over the White House again. That's the one clever thing in Independence Day Resurgence.
Well, so it's probably not worth a 90-minute commitment or however long it is.
Right? I think it's more like 2 hours.
Oh,
something.
Oh, God. Well, this film's so long.
But White House Down, definitely worth the commitment. I think it's a good hangover movie. I mean, New Year's Day is coming up. So
I'll put it on my list.
So it's a lot of fun. Like, and you know, Channing Tatum and Jamie Foxx are a great pair in it. And I enjoyed it a lot.
Do you think there's a future with them in the buddy comedy or... Well, it's been 4 years or...
5 years.
5 years, there you go. So, could be a one-off. It won't be like Lethal Weapon or...
interesting you should mention
the hint
that.
Of Lethal Weapon.
Because the other White House, Die Hard in the White House movie, Olympus Has Fallen, there was a sequel to that one called London Has Fallen.
Oh.
Where
that's definitely on Netflix.
Yeah, yeah, where it's Gerard Butler and as the Secret Service agent and Aaron Eckhart as the president... instead of the White House coming under attack, there's like some sort of like meeting in London. It's like a G8 meeting or something in London, mm-hmm. and the heads of state start getting picked off, and then it's like Aaron Eckhart and Gerard Butler kind of like trying to make it through London before the terrorists get them. And then there's actually another sequel coming out next year called Angel Has Fallen, which is about
God.
It's about Gerard Butler protecting God. No, it's about Gerard Butler being framed for the attempted assassination of the president, and then he has to go and try and prove his innocence and stop another assassination.
Has Gerard Butler softened his accent at all, or is it still impenetrable?
That's the craziest thing about those movies is like, and We Hate Movies did an episode about Olympus Has Fallen, and like it's Special Agent Gerard Butler from Dublin, Oklahoma.
Yeah, it's one of the more serious accents to get over, but maybe he's kind of heading in the direction of Arnie. Arnie didn't bother, so maybe. But
well, that's true.
Jared Butler is actually speaking a version of English, but I can say this because he's my people, right? I can slam him. It's okay. So.
Well, I mean, Gerard Butler did that picture with the Guelph kids this year.
Yes.
So
shout out to Guelph.
Not all bad.
Gerard Butler.
But I believe Gerard Butler more as a Secret Service agent than I do believe him as the guy who created climate change solving technology in Geostorm.
Oh, yeah, that's probably true.
He's not a believable scientist, Gerard Butler, is what I'm saying.
So I wanted to drop in a runner-up for TV. I know I used a TV show once, but if you have some time and you are doing your holiday binge watch or whatever, 6 episodes, Bodyguard. I don't know if you've seen it.
I haven't seen
it. Involves a Scottish cop, but...
Yeah. Richard Madsen, isn't it?
Richard Madsen's behind it? Or you know what? Richard Madden?
Richard Madden,
that's right. Richard Madden, who was in Game of Thrones,
I believe. He was Robb Stark. Yeah.
Which I did not watch, but you did.
I've seen
it. Definitely recommend it. Do you have any other sort of run-up-y things off the top of your head? There's so much good political TV, I think, too. So remember, I was Borgen for me that one year, which I also still recommend. It holds up. Anyway.
Watch Game of Thrones. I don't know.
Game of Thrones is definitely a political drama.
It's a political... it is.
Lots of blood and gore.
Politics will take a back seat as we're getting into the end game. But, I mean, that's a whole other discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it for our year-end movie show, and we hope you liked it. And next week we have our award show. That's on January the 3rd, so we hope you come back for that. You can stay connected to us at our website, opensourcesguelph.com. Find us on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire. Check us out on Twitter at @OS_Guelph, and you can download this and any previous episode of the show on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or through iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. I will be available on Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to my political site, guelphpolitico.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and I blog at spannerbook.wordpress.com.
And we got more great programming here for you here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, so stay tuned. And we will be back here, as I previously stated, back here next Thursday at 5 p.m. for our award show, Open Sources, and we will see you then. We'll be right back.